And we are going to be blessed again, I know, from experience. Because Dr. David Williams, if I can see him, I've seen him here, oh, there he is right in front of me, is going to talk to us about disparities in the delivery of health and health care. Dr. David Williams is a member of our faith community. He is also a professor of public health at Harvard University in the United States of America. As you know, Harvard represents the finest of the American academic institutions. And David, we are privileged to have you here, and I know that you're going to bless us. Thank you very much. David Williams.
Good morning, and it's good to be here, and I thank the organizers for the invitation. Okay, we all set. As I was saying, it's a thrill and privilege to be with you today. My talk today will build on one of the talks we listened to yesterday by Eugenia Villar of the WHO, since it addresses the challenge of disparities in health. Many experts in public health, including the World Health Organization, believe that inequities in health, gaps in health between different population groups and groups within societies as across societies, is the single most significant public health problem of our time. The United States government has Healthy People 2010, was referred to in an earlier presentation. Its overarching goal is to eliminate disparities in health by next year, 2010, which it has already failed colossally so far in doing that. And what I want to do today is to give you an overview of the scientific research on the topic, both the magnitude of the problem and evidence of strategies to address it. I see that my friend and colleague, Sir Michael Mommet, is on the program later. And he certainly has done eminent work in this area, and I will omit the slides I had about his commission at the end of my talk. So social disparities in health, what do we know in terms of the evidence, and what do we know about promising strategies? We all well aware of the fate of the Titanic and the fact that there was huge loss of life on the Titanic. But what is also true was that the loss of life on the Titanic wasn't random across the population. In fact, the socioeconomic status is a term I will use frequently in my talk. Socioeconomic status refers to income, education, occupational status. Persons of high socioeconomic status, as reflected in those who were able to afford a more expensive ticket, were much more likely to survive than those who bought a third-class ticket. That pattern on the Titanic is true in literally every society in the world. Whether measured by income, education, occupation, it influences health in every society. In fact, it is one of the most powerful known determinants of variations in health. It's a better predictor of variations in health of the population than its genetics, than its exposure to carcinogen, and it's even a bigger predictor of variations in health than cigarette smoking. And we generally recognize cigarette smoking as the single most powerful predictor of variations or preventable cause of death in our societies today. A couple examples of that, Americans who've not graduated from high school have a death rate 2 to 3 times higher than those who've graduated from college. National studies in the U.S. show that persons of high income and education have levels of health in their 60s and 70s that persons of low income and education had 30 years earlier. There's a 30-year gap in the quality of health in the United States just by individuals' income and education. Here is one picture of it. This shows the rates of premature mortality, which is death before age 60 nationally in the United States by income level. And you can see that persons of low income in the U.S. are 3 times more likely to die before the age of 60 than persons of high income. What is also evident in these data is that it isn't a threshold effect. It isn't that once you rise above poverty, you're doing better. But it's a gradient effect. at every higher level of economic well-being, health is better. And that pattern, dramatically portrayed in the Whitehall data by Sir Michael Marmot, who will speak to us later, is evident in data from society to society, a very powerful picture. Here is another example, one coming from South Africa, work I've done there, looking at a mental health measure, psychological distress, by income. And you could see that persons of moderate socioeconomic status are 50% more likely to have high levels of psychological distress than persons of high socioeconomic status, and those of low socioeconomic status are 3 times more likely to have high levels of mental distress than those of high socioeconomic status. So this pattern exists across a broad range of outcomes. Very closely tied in the U.S. and across the world with these gaps in health by income and education occupational status are gaps in health by race and ethnicity. So here is an example from the United States looking at life expectancy at birth, and you could see in 1900, whites lived on average 47.6 years, blacks lived on average 33 years. You could see a massive closing of that gap by the year 1950, but since 1950, there hasn't really been much progress in narrowing the gap in health between blacks and whites in the United States. What does this gap in life expectancy really translate to? What does it mean concretely? Well, during the Reagan administration, the federal government issued its first report on black and minority health, and it developed this concept called excess deaths. Excess deaths refer to how many people die in one group, racial group, who wouldn't die if there were no racial disparities in health. The latest reports on the excess deaths in the black population is there are 96,000 black people who die each year in the U.S. who wouldn't die if there were no excess deaths, if there weren't racial disparities in health. What does that mean concretely? Let me try to bring that home. Imagine a fully loaded jumbo jet taking off from the airport here in Geneva with 265 people on board and crashing, and everybody on board died. And that happened today, and tomorrow, and the next day, and every day next week, and every day next month, and every day for a year. That's 96,000 deaths. A fully loaded jumbo jet crashing every day. And that's just the differences between blacks and whites in the United States. Another example, here is the death rates from diabetes for American Indians from 1955, the year the Indian Health Service was formed, to 1998. And what you can see, death rates for whites from diabetes are fairly stable over time, although increasing in more recent years due to the obesity epidemic, but a dramatic increase in death rates for American Indians over time. America is not unique. Here's data from Australia looking at the very high rates of death for the Aboriginal population compared to the non-Indigenous population in Australia, and you can see the rates are about 4, 5, 6 times higher through much of the middle years among women and a similar pattern among men. Are these differences by race due to genetics? No. Here is one example of a study, and I say no blatantly, not that genetics isn't a factor. It certainly is a factor determining our health. It's not an important factor determining group differences in health. There are gene-environment interactions that we want to be aware of, but genetics is not the central explanation of this. The scientific evidence on this is unambiguous and clear. So here is a study looking at high blood pressure rates among West Africans and among blacks of West African origin in the United States. You see, in the U.S., blacks have very high rates of high blood pressure, and many researchers even today think that there's a genetic explanation for these differences. So Richard Cooper and his colleagues, a professor at Loyola University Medical School, said, if there is a genetic difference, let me see what happens among West Africans, and let me look at West African persons in other contexts. Basically, what he found was that blacks in the U.S. have twice the rates of high blood pressure than blacks in Africa. And if we had put on this slide whites in the United States, you'd find whites in America have higher rates of blood pressure than blacks in Africa. So a simple genetic explanation doesn't seem to account for these differences. Well, what is it? Well, we know that race and ethnicity captures differences in living conditions, in quality of life, in socioeconomic status. And here's an example from the country of Brazil, where we look at the opportunities for whites and the patterns for non-whites. So you see the average earnings for men In terms of multiples of the monthly minimum wage, whites have 6 times that compared to non-whites having about 3 times that. So a big difference. And this difference in living conditions is linked to differences in health in Brazil by race and ethnicity. And I'm just showing you illustrations from multiple countries that show the same basic pattern. What the data from Brazil shows is that even when you look at white and non-whites at the same level of income and at the same level of education, the non-whites are still doing more poorly in terms of health. That pattern is also true in U.S. data. Here is one of the most striking slides I'll show you today. This is infant mortality, a very commonly used comparison of overall health. This is showing in the United States all deaths to infants in an entire year. So it's not a sample, it's all of the deaths in a given year to mothers age 20 or over by mother's education. And you could see that as mother's education increases from less than 12 years, less than high school, to 16 or more years, that's college graduates, for every racial group, death rates decline. That's the good news. But the bad news is this striking elevation, higher level of risk that is evident for black women in the United States. So much so that black women who are the most advantaged with a college degree or more education have higher death rates, their infants do, than women who are high school dropouts of other racial groups except American Indians. A very striking pattern of difference that exists in U.S. data. Why? How do we make sense of this? And what can be done about it? Well, we know, and there's a lot of research that shows that socioeconomic status reflects multiple disadvantages. Poor education in childhood and adolescence, less secure employment, working in more difficult, more carcinogenic occupational environments, living in poorer communities and in poorer housing, trying to raise families in difficult situations, and these disadvantages exist literally from the cradle to the grave. What determines health in societies? Research suggests that basic needs are important, like food and water and shelter and security. But once these are met, the nature of what is called the nature of caring and sharing in society determines what is most important. And more egalitarian societies in the U.S., even more egalitarian states have better health than those that are less egalitarian. There is a lot of interest and a lot of research that Adventists would be very interested in that shows how powerfully adult health is shaped by experiences in the first few years of life. The risk of cancer, the risk of heart disease in your 40s and 50s is importantly linked to the conditions you're exposed to in utero and in the first few years of life. Researchers are documenting today that what is called, Jack Shankoff calls, toxic stress in the first 3 years of life, such as poverty, chronic poverty, abuse, or having exposed to a caregiver who is chronically depressed, can lead to actually alterations of brain architecture that affects the ability of that infant not only to deal with that current situation, but with every other stressful situation they will encounter for the rest of their life. And these difficulties affect their health, but their ability to learn even when they enter school. Let me give you an example of how dramatic these exposures are. This is a study done in California, in the Kaiser, a huge healthcare system in the state of California. Look at different adversities that children experience or adults experience when they were children. And this is the percent of adults that reported different experiences. What I want you to look, there's a lot of numbers on this table, but look at the last column. For persons who experience 4 or more of these adversities as a child, they were twice as likely to be a smoker as adult, 60% more likely to be obese, 30% more likely not to exercise, 7 times more likely to be an alcoholic, 5 times more likely to abuse drugs, 10 times more likely to inject drugs, 3 times more likely to have had 50 or more sexual partners. You can see the list goes on. And those make sense because those are, and depression, more likely to depress, more likely to commit suicide. However, they were twice as likely to have heart disease as an adult. almost twice as likely to have any kind of cancer, twice as likely to have had a stroke, three times more likely, four times more likely to have emphysema. So that these early childhood exposures have long-term consequences on future health. One of the other growing areas of research in the last 15 years or so is the extent to which the very nature of civil society and the extent of indignities within society actually harms health. There is a growing body of research of the ways in which experiences of stigmatization and experiences of discrimination adversely impact health. And the research shows that it is one explanation, not the only factor, but one of the contributors to these patterns of health. So I'm giving you one example from hundreds of studies that have literally been conducted around the world. In the wake of September 11th in the United States, there was well-documented increased harassment and discrimination of Arab Americans in the U.S. No question that occurred, and about 6 months after, it declined somewhat. A researcher decided to study Arab American women in the state of California and looked at birth outcomes for these women 6 months before September 11th and 6 months after. And what this researcher found, Diane Lauderdale, that among Arab American women only, in the 6 months after September 11th, that's a period where they were now exposed to increased harassment and discrimination, they were much more likely to have babies that were low birth weight and that were premature. So the exposure of discrimination was affecting not only the health of the mother, but it was affecting the health of the children and putting those children on a trajectory of greater risk for the rest of their lives. Research suggests that what happened among Arab American women in California happens among stigmatized racial and ethnic minority groups in the United States, in Australia, in New Zealand, in South Africa, and across every major European society where they've looked at how immigrants are treated compared to non-immigrant groups. A powerful body of evidence of another social factor that drives health. Let me give you another dramatic example of how the conditions in which we live and work can have dramatic consequences for health. There was major change, political change, that had economic repercussions in the former Soviet Union. And you could see that from 1991 to 1994, a dramatic decline in life expectancy for men by 6 years. That's virtually unheard of in public health circles in a very short window of time to see such a dramatic decline in life expectancy. And we saw that this pattern was evident across multiple conditions, where from 90 to 93, you saw worsening health across multiple outcomes. What drove these differences in health? Why did the health of men declined so dramatically in the Soviet Union? It wasn't due to changes in medical care. In fact, it wasn't due to the rise in infectious diseases. It was increased inflation, unemployment, reduced wages, led to increases in crime, social disintegration, higher levels of stress, declines in food consumption that led to the deterioration of health and living conditions. Health is embedded in these broader conditions in which individuals live and work. One other thing we know, and I'm showing you data here from England, but it's true in data from multiple other countries, that the gaps in health are getting worse over time. The gaps in health between those who are doing well off and those who are not are getting worse over time. So what can we do about this? What are the determinants of health? Well, medical care is one of them. In fact, according to the U.S. Surgeon General, medical care accounts for 10% of the differences in health within populations. 10% is not a lot, but it's still something that we should pay attention to. So what can we do about medical care? One of the things that the Adventist health system and healthcare systems in general need to pay attention to is the scientific evidence is clear that when we treat an individual within the context of the social conditions that they face, even our healthcare delivery is more effective. That seeing the individual not just as a sick organ system, but seeking to address more comprehensively the needs that they have, you can be more effective. Let me give you an example of a study that did this. Len Syme did a study, taking 244 hypertensive patients and randomly assigning them to one of three conditions. One of them, the first one, got routine hypertensive care. The second group got health education. They went to classes once a week for 10 weeks. where a health educator told them about what they needed to know about blood pressure. The third group were blessed to receive a visit at home from an outreach worker. This outreach worker was a lay worker from the community, not a healthcare professional, but who was trained in the knowledge about high blood pressure, as well as trained in resources that existed in the community to help people with problems that they might face. 7 months later, when they tested these three groups of people, they found that those who were in the outreach group who had received a home visit were more likely to have their blood pressure controlled than any of the other two groups. They knew more about blood pressure, their knowledge was greater than any of the other two groups. And they were more compliant in taking their blood pressure medication than any of the other two groups. Everything a healthcare provider wants, that people know and understand about their illness, that they're following through on their doctor's recommendation, and that the medication they're taking actually works. All of those characteristics existed in the group, and what was different about them is that their problems were understood within the context of their lives. But if you go back to my chart on the Surgeon General's recommendations, 50% of the variations in healthcare, and I'm not trying to steal Gary Fraser's thunder, is linked to health behavior. So a lot has to be done in terms of making behavioral changes. What we also know, though, that especially for vulnerable populations, simply providing information is not enough. The last 100 years has taught us that. The best example of that is looking at changes in cigarette smoking over time. It has taken the involvement of multiple groups working together, the use of multiple intervention channels, the use of efforts to inform the public, of economic inducements, of laws and legal regulations and clean indoor laws, and even with all of these working together, we've only been partially effective. What that means is that to be successful in making behavior change, we need to think of what can we do to alter the culture of health, alter the opportunities for health. What can we do to make making healthier choices easier? Research suggests that we need to move upstream, that the centrality of the social environment is crucial. An individual's chances for health are largely unrelated to the receipt of medical care. Medical care is the repair shop. It takes care of us once we get sick. Where we live, learn, work, play, and worship determine the opportunities and chances to be healthy or unhealthy. So health policy, in fact, is policy in all sectors of society that have consequences for health. There's a lot of evidence and a lot of research attention to the role of the environment, and the very community within which individuals live can determine whether they are healthy, whether it's easy for them to live a healthy life, or whether it's a challenge for them to live a healthy life. And that exists across multiple dimensions, whether you be in a healthy community or, in fact, in an unhealthy community. Let me highlight a few examples of research that suggests that simply improving living and working conditions can have a dramatic impact on health, even with no health intervention. One of them, and these are, I cite them because they're examples of randomized controlled trials, the highest level of scientific evidence where individuals were randomly assigned to live in a better neighborhood, nothing was done about their health, and their health was improved. Examples where poor individuals are given income, nothing done about their health was improved. The conditional cash transfer programs in Latin America where poor communities are given additional economic resources and health dramatically improved. Another dramatic example of that is in the United States itself, the civil rights movement that narrowed economic gaps between 1968 and 1978, and during that period of time, health improved. During the decade of the 80s, we lost economically the gains of the civil rights movement, and health worsened. For 4 years in a row after 1984, the life expectancy of blacks in the U.S. actually declined from the 1984 level. During the time of worsening economic conditions, health absolutely worsened. I want to conclude with an example of a commission that I have been serving as staff director for. It's the first National Bipartisan Commission in the United States. As a result of my work with the commission, I've been to the White House twice in the last 6 months and spoke at more than six congressional briefings in the last year. It has made recommendations of what needs to be done to improve America's health. It says we need a twin philosophy of personal responsibility. Every person can choose to be healthier. But we also need a societal commitment to remove the obstacles that prevent many Americans from making healthy decisions. The broad outlines of our recommendations is, given the evidence on early childhood, we have to start early by providing our children the opportunities to be healthy in schools and in every other environment. We need to make healthy foods available, and many Americans live in food deserts, areas in rural America and in urban America where there's no access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And then we need to create healthy communities in every environmental context, in our churches, in our schools, in our workplaces, because in all of these places, health, in fact, is created. Basically, we are saying that to improve health, we need to look at the social and economic opportunities and resources and the living and working conditions in healthy communities as well. The World Health Commission, World Health Organization also issued a commission. I'm not going to talk about it. Let me conclude with some guiding principles that I think are very important. Health policy must be refined then to address all of those factors. And if we are effectively going to, as a church, to improve individuals' health, we need to look at what the drivers of health are. We also need to recognize that strategies that generally address health in general will not close the gaps in health. We need to have specific targeted strategies to improve the health of disadvantaged groups more rapidly than the rest of the population. And then we cannot view populations just from a deficit perspective. We need to think of what are their strengths, what are their resources, and then religion is one of them that is powerfully linked to health in multiple ways. There is a lot that we can do in improving health. We need a new path to health. We need to work collaboratively. We need to use all the knowledge that we have. And finally, for the faith community and for these gaps in health that I'm talking about, it reminds us of the importance of falling back on some of the prophetic words that we have been given, both in Scripture and through the spirit of prophecy. Isaiah 58 is the passage that the spirit of prophecy focuses more clearly than any other passage in Scripture. It is described as the work of every church. And what is that work? What is the kind of fast that God is calling us to? To break the chains of injustice, to get rid of exploitation in the workplace, to free the oppressed, to cancel debts. What God is interested is in seeing you do is sharing your food with the hungry, inviting the homeless poor into your homes, putting clothes on the shivering ill-clad, being available to your own families. If you are generous with the hungry and start giving yourselves to the down and out, your lives will glow in the darkness. Your shadowed lives will be bathed in sunlight. And he says, I will always show you where to go. I'll give you full life in the emptiest of places, firm muscles and strong bones. So we even have the promise of good health as we engage in the work of making others healthier. Thank you.